direct entrance. It wasn't too hard to find. A cluster of police cars stood scattered outside one row of double doors. She nosed her big car in among them. I jumped out of the car quickly, before she could put her hand on my knee. She got out and looked at me for a moment. Her mouth twitched. "I'll take a look," I said. I did not quite run into the arena. I was fleeing Lagerta, yes, but I was also very anxious to get inside, to see what my playful friend had done, to be near his work, to inhale the wonder, to learn. The inside echoed with the organized bedlam typical of any murder scene, and yet it seemed to me that there was a special electricity in the air, a slightly hushed feeling of excitement and tension that you wouldn't find at any ordinary murder, a sense that this one was different somehow, that new and wonderful things might happen because we were out here on the cutting edge. But maybe that was just me. A clot of people stood around the nearby net. Several of them wore Broward uniforms. They had their arms folded and watched as Captain Matthews argued about jurisdiction with a man in a tailored suit. As I got closer, I saw Angel No Relation in an unusual position, standing above a balding man who was on one knee poking at a stack of carefully wrapped packages. I stopped at the railing to look through the glass. There it was, only 10 feet away. It looked so perfect in the cold purity of the newly zambonied hockey rink. Any jeweler will tell you that finding the right setting is vitally important, and this, it was stunning, absolutely perfect. I felt just a little dizzy, uncertain of whether the railing would hold my weight, as if I might simply pass straight down through the hard wood like a mist. Even from the railing, I could tell. He had taken the time. He had done it right, in spite of what must have seemed like a very close call on the causeway only minutes before. Or had he known somehow that I meant him no harm? And since I brought it up anyway, did I in fact mean him no harm? Did I truly mean to track him to his lair and come up on point all a quiver for advancing Deborah's career? Of course that was what I thought I was doing. But would I be strong enough to carry through with it if things kept getting so interesting? Here we were at the hockey rink, where I had whiled away many pleasant and contemplative hours. Wasn't this even more proof that this artist, excuse me, I mean killer, of course, was moving on a track parallel to mine? Just look at the lovely work he had done here. And the head, that was the key. Surely it was too important as a piece of what he was doing simply to leave it behind. Had he thrown it to frighten me, send me into paroxysms of terror, horror, and dread? Or had he known somehow that I felt the same way he did? Could he, too, feel the connection between us, and he just wanted to be playful? Was he teasing me? He had to have some important reason for leaving me such a trophy. I was experiencing powerful, dizzying sensations. How could he be feeling nothing? Lagerta came up beside me. "You're in such a hurry," she said, a slight edge of complaint in her voice. "Are you afraid she'll get away?" She nodded at the stacked body parts. I knew that somewhere inside me was a clever answer, something that would make her smile, charm her a little more, smooth over my awkward run from her clutches. But standing there at the rail, looking down at the body on the ice in the goalie's net, in the presence of greatness, one might say, no wit came out. I did manage not to yell at her to shut up, but it was a very near thing. "I had to see," I said truthfully, and then recovered enough to add, "It's the home team's net." She slapped my arm playfully. "You're awful," she said. Luckily, Sergeant Doakes came over to us, and the detective didn't have time for a kittenish giggle, which would have been more than I could take. As always, Doakes seemed more interested in finding a way to get a good grip on my ribs and pull me open than anything else, and he gave me such a warm and penetrating look of welcome that I faded quickly away and left him to Lagerta. He stared after me, watching me with an expression that said I had to be guilty of something, and he would very much like to examine my entrails to find out what. I'm sure he would have been happier someplace where the police were permitted to break the occasional tibia or femur. I circled away from him, moving slowly around the rink to the nearest place where I could get in. I had just found it, when something came at me on my blind side and hit me rather hard in the ribs. I straightened up to face my assailant, with a certain bruise and a strained smile. "Hello, dear sister," I said. "So nice to see a friendly face."
"Bastard!" she hissed at me.
"Quite probably," I said. "But why bring it up now?"
"Because, you miserable son of a bitch, you had a lead and you didn't call me."
A lead? I almost stuttered. "What makes you think..."
"Cut the crap, Dexter," Deborah snarled. "You weren't driving around at 4 a.m. looking for hookers. You knew where he was, goddammit."
Light dawned. I had been so wrapped up in my own problems, starting with the dream, and the fact that it had obviously been something more than that, and continuing on through my nightmarish encounter with Lagerta, that it did not occur to me that I had wronged Deborah. I had not shared. Of course she would be angry. "Not a lead, Deb," I said, trying to soothe her feelings a bit. "Nothing solid like that, just a feeling, a thought, that's all. It was really nothing." She shoved again.
"Except that it was something," she snarled. "You found him."
"Actually, I'm not sure," I said. "I think he found me."
"Quit being clever," she said, and I spread my hands to show how impossible that would be. "You promised, goddamn you!"
I did not remember making any kind of promise that might cover calling her in the middle of the night and telling her my dreams, but this didn't seem like a very politic thing to say, so I didn't. "I'm sorry, Deb," I said instead. "I really didn't think it would pan out. It was just a hunch, really." I was certainly not going to attempt any explanation of the parapsychology involved, even with Deb, or perhaps especially not with her. But another thought hit me. I lowered my voice. "Maybe you could help me a little. What am I supposed to tell them if they ever decide to ask what I was doing driving around down there at 4 a.m.?
Has Lagerta interviewed you yet?"
"Exhaustively," I said, fighting down a shudder. Deb made a disgusted face.
"And she didn't ask."
It was not a question. "I'm sure the detective has a great deal on her mind," I said. I did not add that apparently some of it was me. "But sooner or later somebody will ask." I looked over to where she was directing the operation. "Probably Sergeant Doakes," I said with real dread. She nodded. "He's a decent cop, if he could just lose some attitude." "Attitude may be all he is," I said, "but he doesn't like me for some reason. He'll ask anything if he thinks it will make me squirm."
"So, tell him the truth," Deborah said, deadpan. "But first, tell it to me."
And she poked me again in the same spot. "Please, Deb," I said, "you know how easily I bruise."
"I don't know," she said, "but I feel like finding out."
"It won't happen again," I promised. "It was just one of those 3 a.m. inspirations, Deborah. What would you have said if I had called you about it and then it turned out to be nothing?"
"But it didn't. It turned out to be something," she said with another push.
"I really didn't think it would, and I would have felt stupid dragging you in on it.
Imagine how I would have felt if he had killed you," she said.
It took me by surprise. I couldn't even begin to imagine how she would have felt. Regret? Disappointment? Anger? That sort of thing is way beyond me, I'm afraid. So I just repeated, "I'm sorry, Deb." And then, because I am the kind of cheerful Pollyanna who always finds the bright side, I added, "But at least the refrigerated truck was there." She blinked at me.
"The truck was where?" she said.
"Oh, Deb," I said, "they didn't tell you?" She hit me even harder in the same place.
"God damn it, Dexter," she hissed. "What about the truck?"
"It was there, Deb," I said, somewhat embarrassed by her nakedly emotional reaction, and also, of course, by the fact that a good-looking woman was beating the crap out of me. "He was driving a refrigerated truck when he threw the head." She grabbed my arms and stared at me.
"The fuck you say,"
she finally said. "The fuck I do."
"Jesus,"
she said, staring off into space and no doubt seeing her promotion floating there somewhere above my head.
and she was probably going to go on, but at that moment Angel No Relation lifted his voice over the echoing din of the arena.
"Detective?"
he called, looking over at Lagerta. It was a strange, unconscious sound, the half-strangled cry of a man who never makes loud noises in public, and something about it brought instant quiet to the room. The tone was part shock and part triumph. "I found something important, but oh my God!" All eyes turned to Angel, and he nodded down at the crouching bald man who was slowly, carefully removing something from the top package. The man finally pulled the thing out, fumbled, and dropped it, and it skittered across the ice. He reached for it and slipped, sliding after the brightly gleaming thing from the package until they both came to rest against the boards. Hand shaking, Angel grabbed for it, got it, and held it up for all of us to see. The sudden quiet in the building was awe-inspiring, breathtaking, beautiful, like the overwhelming crash of applause at the unveiling of any work of genius. It was the rearview mirror from the truck. Chapter 11. The great blanket of stunned silence lasted for only a moment. Then the buzz of talk in the arena took on a new note as people strained to see, to explain, to speculate. A mirror. What the hell did it mean? Good question. In spite of feeling so very moved by the thing, I didn't have any immediate theories about what it meant. Sometimes great art is like that. It affects you, and you can't say why. Was it deep symbolism? A cryptic message? A wrenching plea for help and understanding? Impossible to say, and to me not the most important thing at first. I just wanted to breathe it in. Let others worry about how it had gotten there. After all, maybe it had just fallen off, and he decided to throw it away in the nearest handy garbage bag. Not possible, of course not. And now I couldn't help thinking about it. The mirror was there for some very important reason. These were not garbage bags to him. As he had now proved so elegantly with this hockey rink setting, presentation was an important part of what he was doing. He would not be casual in any detail. And because of that, I began to think about what the mirror might mean. I had to believe that, as improvised as it might be, putting it in with the body parts was exceedingly deliberate. And I had the further feeling, burbling up from somewhere behind my lungs, that this was a very careful, very private message. To me? If not me, then whom? The rest of the act was speaking to the world at large. See what I am. See what we all are. See what I am doing about it. A truck's mirror wasn't part of the statement. Segmenting the body, draining the blood, this was necessary and elegant. But the mirror, and especially if it turned out to be from the truck that I had chased, that was different. Elegant, yes, but what did it say about the way things really are? Nothing. It was added on for some other purpose, and that purpose had to be a new and different kind of statement. I could feel the electricity of the thought surging through me. If it was from that truck, it could only be meant for me. But what did it mean?
"What the hell is that about?" Deb said beside me. "A mirror. Why?"
"I don't know," I said, still feeling its power throb through me. "But I will bet you dinner at Joe's Stone Crabs that it came from the refrigerator truck."
"No bet," she said. "But at least it settles one important question."
I looked at her, startled. Could she really have made some intuitive jump that I had missed? "What question, sis?" She nodded at the cluster of management-level cops still squabbling at the edges of the rink.
"Jurisdiction. This one is ours. Come on."
On the surface, Detective Lagerta was not impressed with this new piece of evidence. Perhaps she was hiding a deep and abiding concern for the symbolism of the mirror and all it implied under a carefully crafted facade of indifference. Either that, or she really was dumb as a box of rocks. She was still standing with Doakes. To his credit, he looked troubled, but maybe his face had simply gotten tired from its perpetual mean glare and he was trying something new.
"Morgan," Lagerta said to Deb, "I didn't recognize you with clothes on."
I guess it's possible to miss a lot of obvious things, detective, Deb said before I could stop her.
It is, Lagarda said. That's why some of us never make detective.
It was a complete and effortless victory, and Lagarda didn't even wait to see the shot go home. She turned away from Deb and spoke to Doakes. Find out who has keys to the arena. Who could get in here whenever they want it?
Uh-huh, said Doakes. Check all the locks, see if somebody busted in.
No, Lagarda told him with a pretty little frown. We got our ice connection now. She glanced at Deborah. That refrigerated truck is just to confuse us.
Back to Doakes. The tissue damage had to come from the ice, from here, so the killer is connected to the ice in this place.
She looked one last time at Deborah. Not the truck.
Uh-huh, said Doakes.
He didn't sound convinced, but he wasn't in charge. Lagarda looked over at me. I think you can go home, Dexter, she said. I know where you live when I need you.
At least she didn't wink.
Deborah walked me to the big double doors of the arena. If this keeps up, I'll be a crossing guard in a year, she grumbled at me. Nonsense, Deb, I said. 2 months, max.
Thanks.
Well, really, you can't challenge her openly like that. Didn't you see how Sergeant Doakes did it? Have some subtlety, for God's sake.
Subtlety.
She stopped dead in her tracks and grabbed me. Listen, Dexter, she said. This isn't some kind of game here. But it is, Deb. A political game, and you're not playing it properly.
I'm not playing anything, she snarled. There are human lives at stake. There's a butcher running loose, and he's going to stay loose as long as that half-wit Lagarda is running things.
I fought down a surge of hope.
That may be so.
It is so,
Deb insisted. But, Deborah, you can't change that by getting yourself exiled to Coconut Grove traffic duty.
No, she said. But I can change it by finding the killer.
Well, there it was. Some people just have no idea how the world works. She was otherwise a very smart person, truly she was. She had simply inherited all of Harry's earthy directness, his straightforward way of dealing with things, without latching on to any of his accompanying wisdom. With Harry, bluntness had been a way to cut through the fecal matter. With Deborah, it was a way of pretending there wasn't any. I got a ride back to my car with one of the patrol units outside the arena. I drove home, imagining I had kept the head, wrapped it carefully in tissue paper, and placed it in the back seat to take home with me. Terrible and silly, I know. For the first time, I understood those sad men, usually Shriners, who fondle women's shoes or carry around dirty underwear. An awful feeling that made me want to shower almost as much as I wanted to stroke the head. But I didn't have it. Nothing for it but to go home. I drove slowly, a few miles per hour under the speed limit. In Miami, that's like wearing a kick me sign on your back. No one actually kicked me, of course. They would have had to slow down for that. But I was honked at 7 times, flipped off 8, and 5 cars simply roared around me, either onto the sidewalk or through oncoming traffic. But today, even the energetic high spirits of the other drivers couldn't cheer me. I was dead tired and bemused, and I needed to think, away from the echoing din of the arena and the bonehead blather of Lagarda. Driving slowly gave me time to wonder, to work through the meaning of all that had happened. And I found that one silly phrase kept ringing in my head, bouncing off the rocks and crannies of my exhausted brain. It took on a life of its own. The more I heard it in my thoughts, the more sense it made. And beyond sense, it became a kind of seductive mantra. It became the key to thinking about the killer, the head rolling into the street, the rearview mirror tucked away amid the wonderfully dry body parts. If it had been me. As in, if it had been me, what would I be saying with the mirror? And if it had been me, what would I have done with the truck? Of course, it had not been me, and that kind of envy is very bad for the soul. But since I was not aware of having one, it didn't matter. If it had been me, the truck would be run into a ditch somewhere not too far from the arena, and then I would get far away from there fast. In a stashed car? A stolen one? It would depend. If it had been me, would I have planned on leaving the body at the arena all along?
or had that come up as a response to the chase on the causeway? Except that made no sense. He could not have counted on anyone chasing him out to North Bay Village, could he? But then why did he have the head ready to throw? And then why take the rest to the arena? It seemed like an odd choice. Yes, there was a great deal of ice there, and the coldness was all to the good, but the vast, clattery space was really not appropriate for my kind of intimate moment, if it had been me. There was a terrible, wide-open desolation that was not at all conducive to real creativity. Fun to visit, but not a real artist's studio. A dumping ground and not a workspace. It just didn't have the proper feeling to it. If it had been me, that is. So the arena was a bold stroke into unexplored territory. It would give the police fits, and it would most definitely lead them in the wrong direction, if they ever figured out that there was a direction to be led in, which seemed increasingly unlikely. And to top it off with the mirror, if I was right about the reasons for selecting the arena, then the addition of the mirror would of course support that. It would be a comment on what had just happened, connected to leaving the head. It would be a statement that would bring together all the other threads, wrap them up as neatly as the stacked body parts, an elegant underlining to a major work. Now, what would the statement be, if it was me? I see you. Well, of course that was it, in spite of being somewhat obvious. I see you. I know you're behind me, and I am watching you. But I am far ahead of you, too, controlling your course and setting your speed and watching you follow me. I see you. I know who you are and where you are, and all you know about me is that I am watching. I see you. That felt right. Why didn't it make me feel better? Further, how much of this should I tell poor dear Deborah? This was becoming so intensely personal that it was a struggle to remember that there was a public side to it, a side that was important to my sister and her career. I could not begin to tell her, or anyone, that I thought the killer was trying to tell me something, if I had the wit to hear and reply. But the rest? Was there something I needed to tell her, and did I actually want to? It was too much. I needed sleep before I could sort all this out. I did not quite whimper as I crawled into my bed, but it was a very near thing. I allowed sleep to roll over me quickly, just letting go into the darkness, and I got nearly 2.5 full hours of sleep before the telephone rang. "It's me," said the voice on the other end. "Of course it is," I said. "Deborah, wasn't it?" And of course it was. "I found the refrigerated truck." "Well, congratulations, Deb. That's very good news." There was a rather long silence on the other end. "Deb," I said finally, "that is good news, isn't it?" "No," she said. "Oh." I felt the need for sleep thumping my head like carpet beaters on a prayer rug, but I tried to concentrate. Deb, what did you... what happened?" "I made the match," she said, "made absolutely certain, pictures and part numbers and everything. So I told LaGuardia like a good scout." "And she didn't believe you?" I asked incredulously. "She probably did." I tried to blink, but my eyes wanted to stick shut, so I gave it up. "I'm sorry, Deb. One of us isn't making much sense. Is it me?" "I tried to explain it to her," Deborah said in a very small, very tired voice that gave me a terrible feeling of sinking under the waves without a bailing bucket. "I gave her the whole thing. I was even polite." "That's very good," I said. "What did she say?"
"Nothing," Deb said.
"Nothing at all?"
"Nothing at all," Deb repeated.
"Except she just says, thanks, in a kind of way like you'd say it to the valet parking attendant. And she gives me this funny little smile and turns away." "Well, but Deb," I said, "you can't really expect her to..." "And then I found out why she smiled like that," Deb said, "like I'm some kind of unwashed half-wit, and she's finally figured out where to lock me up."
"Oh, no," I said. "You mean you're off the case?"
"We're all off the case, Dexter.
Deb said, her voice as tired as I felt. Lagerta's made an arrest.
There was far too much silence on the line all of a sudden, and I couldn't think at all, but at least I was wide awake.
What? I said.
Lagerta has arrested somebody. Some guy who works at the arena. She has him in custody, and she's sure he's the killer.
That's not possible, I said, although I knew it was possible, the brain-dead bitch.
Lagerta, not Deb. I know that, Dexter, but don't try to tell Lagerta. She's sure she got the right guy.
How sure? I asked. My head was spinning, and I felt a little bit like throwing up. I couldn't really say why.
Deb snorted.
She has a press conference in 1 hour, she said. For her, that's positive.
The pounding in my head got too loud to hear what Deb might have said next.
Lagerta had made an arrest?
Who?
Who could she possibly have tagged for it?
Could she truly ignore all the clues, the smell and feel and taste of these kills, and arrest somebody? Because nobody who could do what this killer had done, was doing, could possibly allow a pimple like Lagerta to catch him. Never! I would bet my life on it.
No, Deborah, I said. No, not possible. She's got the wrong guy.
Deborah laughed, a tired, dirty up-to-here cop's laugh.
Yeah, she said. I know it.
You know it. But she doesn't know it. And you want to know something funny? Neither does he.
That made no sense at all.
What are you saying, Deb? Who doesn't know?
She repeated that awful little laugh.
The guy she arrested. I guess he must be almost as confused as Lagerta, Dex. Because he confessed.
What?
He confessed, Dexter. The bastard confessed.
Chapter 12.
His name was Darryl Earl McHale, and he was what we like to call a two-time loser. 12 of his last 20 years had been spent as a guest of the state of Florida. Dear Sergeant Doakes had managed to dig his name out of the arena's personnel files in a computer cross-check for employees with a record of violence or felony convictions. McHale's name had popped up twice. Darryl Earl was a drunk and a wife-beater. Apparently, he occasionally knocked over filling stations, too, just for the entertainment value. He could be relied on to hold down a minimum wage job for a month or two, but then some fine Friday night, he'd throw back a few six-packs and start to believe he was the wrath of God. So he'd drive around until he found a gas station that just pissed him off. He'd charge in waving a weapon, take the money, and drive away. Then he'd use his massive $80 or $90 haul to buy a few more six-packs, until he felt so good he just had to beat up on somebody. Darryl Earl was not a large man, 5'6" and scrawny, so to play it safe, the somebody he beat on usually turned out to be his wife. Things being what they were, he'd actually gotten away with it a couple of times. But one night he went a little too far with his wife and put her into traction for a month. She pressed charges, and since Darryl Earl already had a record, he'd done some serious time. He still drank, but he'd apparently been frightened enough at Rayford to straighten out just a bit. He'd gotten a job as a janitor at the arena and actually held on to it. As far as we could tell, he hadn't beaten up his wife for ages. And more, our boy had even had a few moments of fame when the Panthers made their run at the Stanley Cup. Part of his job had been to run out and clean up when the fans threw objects on the ice. That Stanley Cup year, this had been a major job, since every time the Panthers scored, the fans threw 3,000 or 4,000 plastic rats onto the rink. Darryl Earl had to schlep out and pick them all up. Boring work, no doubt. And so, encouraged by a few snorts of very cheap vodka one night, he'd picked up one of the plastic rats and done a little rat dance. The crowd ate it up and yelled for more. They began to call for it when Darryl Earl skidded out onto the ice. Darryl Earl did the dance for the rest of the season. Plastic rats were forbidden nowadays. Even if they had been required by federal statute, nobody would have been throwing them. The Panthers hadn't scored a goal since the days when Miami had an honest mayor, sometime in the last century. But McHale still showed up at the games, hoping for one last on-camera two-step. At the press conference, Legerta played that part beautifully. She made it sound like the memory of his small fame had driven Darryl Earle over the edge into murder. And of course, with his drunkenness and his record of violence toward women, he was the perfect suspect for this series of stupid and brutal murders. But Miami's hookers could rest easy. The killing was over. Driven by the overwhelming pressure of an intense and merciless investigation, Darryl Earle had confessed. Case closed. Back to work, girls. The press ate it up. You couldn't really blame them, I suppose. Legerta did a masterful job of presenting just enough fact, colored with high-gloss wishful thinking, that nearly anyone would have been convinced. And of course you don't actually have to take an IQ test to become a reporter. Even so, I always hope for just the smallest glimmer. And I'm always disappointed. Perhaps I saw too many black-and-white movies as a child. I still thought the cynical, world-weary drunk from the large Metropolitan Daily was supposed to ask an awkward question and force the investigators to carefully re-examine the evidence. But, sadly, life does not always imitate art. And at Legerta's press conference, the part of Spencer Tracy was played by a series of male and female models with perfect hair and tropical weight suits. Their penetrating questions amounted to, how did it feel to find the head? And, can we have some pictures? One lone reporter, Nick something from the local NBC TV affiliate, asked Legerta if she was sure McHale was the killer. But when she said that the overwhelming preponderance of evidence indicated that this was the case, and anyway the confession was conclusive, he let it go. Either he was satisfied or the words were too big. And so there it was. Case closed. Justice done. The mighty machinery of Metro Miami's awesome crime-fighting apparatus had once again triumphed over the dark forces besieging our fair city. It was a lovely show. Legerta handed out some very sinister-looking mug shots of Darryl Earle, stapled to those new glossy shots of herself, investigating a $250-an-hour high-fashion photographer on South Beach. It made a wonderfully ironic package, the appearance of danger and the lethal reality so very different. Because however coarse and brutal Darryl Earle looked, the real threat to society was Legerta. She had called off the hounds, closed down the hue and cry, sent people back to bed in a burning building. Was I the only one who could see that Darryl Earle McHale could not possibly be the killer? That there was a style and wit here that a brickhead like McHale couldn't even understand? I had never been more alone than I was in my admiration for the real killer's work. The very body parts seemed to sing to me, a rhapsody of bloodless wonder that lightened my heart and filled my veins with an intoxicating sense of awe. But it was certainly not going to interfere with my zeal in capturing the real killer, a cold and wanton executioner of the innocent who absolutely must be brought to justice. Right, Dexter? Right? Hello? I sat in my apartment, rubbing my sleep-crusted eyes and thinking about the show I had just watched. It had been as near perfect as a press conference could be without free food and nudity. Legerta had clearly pulled every string she had ever gotten a hand on in order to make it the biggest, splashiest press conference possible. And it had been. And for perhaps the first time in her Gucci-licking career, Legerta really and truly believed she had the right man. She had to believe it. It was kind of sad, really. She thought she had done everything right this time. She wasn't just making political moves. In her mind, she was cashing in on a clean and well-lit piece of work. She'd solved the crime, done it her way, caught the bad guy, stopped the killing. Well-earned applause all around for a job well done, and what a lovely surprise she would get when the next body turned up. Because I knew, with no room for doubt, that the killer was still out there. He was probably watching the press conference on Channel 7, the channel of choice for people with an eye for carnage,
At the moment, he would be laughing too hard to hold a blade, but that would pass. And when it did, his sense of humor would no doubt prompt him to comment on the situation. For some reason, the thought did not overwhelm me with fear and loathing and a grim determination to stop this madman before it was too late. Instead, I felt a little surge of anticipation. I knew it was very wrong, and perhaps that made it feel even better. Oh, I wanted this killer stopped, brought to justice, yes, certainly. But did it have to be soon? There was also a small trade-off to make. If I was going to do my little part to stop the real killer, then I should at least make something positive happen at the same time. And as I thought it, my telephone rang. "Yes, I saw it," I said into the receiver. "Jesus," said Deborah on the other end. "I think I'm going to be sick." "Well, I won't mop your fevered brow, sis. There's work to be done." "Jesus," she repeated. Then, "What work?" "Tell me," I asked her. "Are you in ill odor, sis?" "I'm tired, Dexter, and I'm more pissed off than I've ever been in my life. What's that in English?" "I'm asking if you are in what Dad would have called the doghouse. Is your name Mud in the department? Has your professional reputation been muddied, damaged, sullied, colored, rendered questionable?" "Between Lagerta's backstabbing and the Einstein thing, my professional reputation is shit," she said with more sourness than I would have thought possible in someone so young. "Good. It's important that you don't have anything to lose." She snorted. "Glad I could help, 'cause I'm there, Dexter. If I sink any lower in the department, I'll be making coffee for community relations. Where is this going, Dex?" I closed my eyes and leaned all the way back in my chair. "You are going to go on record, with the captain and the department itself, as believing that Darryl Earle is the wrong man and that another murder is going to take place. You will present a couple of compelling reasons culled from your investigation, and you will be the laughingstock of Miami Metro for a little while." "I already am," she said. "No big deal. But is there some reason for this?" I shook my head. It was sometimes hard for me to believe she could be so naive. "Sister dearest," I said, "you don't truly believe Darryl Earle is guilty, do you?" She didn't answer. I could hear her breathing, and it occurred to me that she must be tired, too, every bit as tired as I was, but without the jolt of energy I got from being certain I was right. "Deb?" "The guy confessed, Dexter," she said at last, and I heard the utter fatigue in her voice. I've been wrong before, even when... I mean, but he confessed. Doesn't that... Shit, maybe we should just let it go, Dex." "O ye of little faith," I said. "She's got the wrong guy, Deborah, and you are now going to rewrite the politics." "Sure I am." "Darryl Earle McHale is not it," I said. "There's absolutely no doubt about it." "Even if you're right, so what?" she said. Now it was my turn to blink and wonder. "Excuse me?" "Well, look, if I'm this killer, why don't I realize I'm off the hook now? With this other guy arrested, the heat's off, you know. Why don't I just stop? Or even take off for someplace else and start over?" "Impossible," I said. "You don't understand how this guy thinks." "Yeah, I know," she said. "How come you do?" I chose to ignore that. "He's going to stay right here, and he's going to kill again. He has to show us all what he thinks of us." "Which is what?" "It's not good," I admitted. "We've done something stupid by arresting an obvious twinkie like Darryl Earle. That's funny." "Ha ha," Deb said with no amusement. "But we've also insulted him. We've given this lowbrow, brain-dead redneck all the credit for his work, which is like telling Jackson Pollock your 6-year-old could have painted that." "Jackson Pollock? The painter? Dexter, this guy's a butcher." "In his own way, Deborah, he is an artist, and he thinks of himself that way."
"For Christ's sake, that's the stupidest—"
"Trust me, Deb."
"Sure, I trust you. Why shouldn't I trust you? So we have an angrily amused artist who's not going anywhere, right?"
"Right," I said.
He has to do it again, and it has to be under our noses, and it probably has to be a little bigger.
You mean he's going to kill a fat hooker this time?
Bigger in scale, Deborah. Larger in concept. Splashier.
Oh, splashier, sure, like with a mulcher.
The stakes have gone up, Debs. We've pushed him and insulted him a little, and the next kill will reflect that.
Uh-huh, she said. And how would that work?
I don't really know, I admitted.
But you're sure?
That's right, I said.
Swell, she said. Now I know what to watch for.
Chapter 13. I knew when I walked in my front door after work on Monday that something was wrong. Someone had been in my apartment. The door was not broken. The windows were not jimmied, and I couldn't see any signs of vandalism, but I knew. Call it sixth sense or whatever you like. Someone had been here. Maybe I was smelling pheromones the intruder had left in my air molecules. Or perhaps my lazy boy recliner's aura had been disturbed. It didn't matter how I knew. I knew. Somebody had been in my apartment while I had been at work. That might seem like no big deal. This was Miami, after all. People come home every day to find their TVs gone, their jewelry and electronics all taken away, their space violated, their possessions rifled, and their dog pregnant. But this was different. Even as I did a quick search through the apartment, I knew I would find nothing missing. And I was right. Nothing was missing. But something had been added. It took me a few minutes to find it. I suppose some work-induced reflex made me check the obvious things first. When an intruder has paid a visit, in the natural course of events your things are gone. Toys, valuables, private relics, the last few chocolate chip cookies. So I checked. But all my things were unmolested. The computer, the sound system, the TV and VCR, all right where I had left them. Even my small collection of precious glass slides was tucked away on the bookcase, each with its single drop of dried blood in place. Everything was exactly as I had left it. I checked the private areas next, just to be sure. Bedroom, bathroom, medicine cabinet. They were all fine, too, all apparently undisturbed. And yet there was a feeling suspended in the air over every object that it had been examined, touched, and replaced with such perfect care that even the dust motes were in their proper positions. I went back into the living room, sank into my chair, and looked around, suddenly unsure. I had been absolutely positive that someone had been here, but why? And who did I imagine was so interested in little old me that they would come in and leave my modest home exactly as it had been? Because nothing was missing, nothing disturbed. The pile of newspapers in the recycle box might be leaning slightly to the left, but was that my imagination? Couldn't it have been a breeze from the air conditioner? Nothing was really different. Nothing changed or missing. Nothing. And why would anyone break into my apartment at all? There was nothing special about it. I'd made sure of that. It was part of building my Harry profile. Blend in. Act normal. Even boring. Don't do anything or own anything that might cause comment. So had I done. I had no real valuables other than a stereo and a computer. There were other, far more attractive targets in the immediate neighborhood. And in any case, why would somebody break in and then take nothing, do nothing, leave no sign? I leaned back and closed my eyes. Almost certainly I was imagining the whole thing. This was surely just jangled nerves, a symptom of sleep deprivation and worrying too much about Deborah's critically injured career. Just one more small sign that poor old Dexter was drifting off into deep water, making that last painless transition from sociopath to psychopath. It is not necessarily crazy in Miami to assume that you are surrounded by anonymous enemies, but to act like it is socially unacceptable. They would have to put me away at last. And yet the feeling was so strong. I tried to shake it off, just a whim, a twitch of the nerves, a passing indigestion. I stood up, stretched, took a deep breath, and tried to think pretty thoughts. None came. I shook my head and went into the kitchen for a drink of water, and there it was. There it was. I stood in front of the refrigerator and looked, I don't know how long, just staring stupidly. Attached to the refrigerator, hair pinned to the door with one of my small tropical fruit magnets, was a Barbie doll's head. I did not remember leaving it there. I did not remember ever owning one. It seemed like the kind of thing I would remember. I reached to touch the little plastic head. It swung gently, thumping against the freezer door with a small thack sound. It turned in a tiny quarter circle until Barbie looked up at me with alert collie dog interest. I looked back. Without really knowing what I was doing or why, I opened the freezer door. Inside, lying carefully on top of the ice basket, was Barbie's body. The legs and arms had been pulled off, and the body had been pulled apart at the waist. The pieces were stacked neatly, wrapped, and tied with a pink ribbon. And stuck into one tiny Barbie hand was a small accessory, a Barbie vanity mirror. After a long moment, I closed the freezer door. I wanted to lie down and press my cheek against the cool linoleum. Instead, I reached out with my little finger and flipped Barbie's head. It went thack, thack against the door. I flipped it again, thack, thack. Whee! I had a new hobby. I left the doll where it was and went back to my chair, sinking deep into the cushions and closing my eyes. I knew I should be feeling upset, angry, afraid, violated, filled with paranoid hostility and righteous rage. I didn't. Instead, I felt, what? More than a little lightheaded? Anxious, perhaps? Or was it exhilaration? There was, of course, no possible doubt about who had been in my apartment, unless I could swallow the idea that some stranger, for unknown reasons, had randomly chosen my apartment as the ideal spot to display his decapitated Barbie doll. No. I had been visited by my favorite artist. How he had found me was not important. It would have been easy enough to jot down my license number on the causeway that night. He'd had plenty of time to watch me from his hiding place behind the filling station, and then anyone with computer literacy could find my address, and having found it, it would be easy enough to slip in, take a careful look around, and leave a message. And here was the message. The head hung separately, the body parts stacked on my ice tray, and that damned mirror again. Combined with the total lack of interest in everything else in the apartment, it all added up to only one thing. But what? What was he saying? He could have left anything or nothing. He could have jammed a bloody butcher knife through a cow's heart and into my linoleum. I was grateful he hadn't. What a mess. But why Barbie? Aside from the obvious fact that the doll reflected the body of his last kill, why tell me about it? And was this more sinister than some other gooier message? Or less? Was it, I'm watching and I'll get you? Or was he saying, hi, wanna play? And I did. Of course I did. But what about the mirror? To include it this time gave it meaning far beyond the truck and the chase on the causeway. Now it had to mean much more. All I could come up with was, look at yourself. And what sense did that make? Why should I look at myself? I am not vain enough to enjoy that. At least I am not vain about my physical appearance. And why would I even want to look at myself when what I really wanted was to see the killer? So there had to be some other meaning to the mirror that I was not getting. But even here I could not be sure. It was possible that there was no real meaning at all. I did not want to believe that of so elegant an artist, but it was possible. And the message could very well be a private, deranged, and sinister one. There was absolutely no way to know. And so there was also no way to know what I should do about it, if indeed I should do anything.
I made the human choice. Funny when you think about it, me, making a human choice. Harry would have been proud. Humanly, I decided to do nothing. Wait and see. I would not report what had happened. After all, what was there to report? Nothing was missing. There was nothing at all to say officially, except, Captain Matthews, I thought you should know that someone apparently broke into my apartment and left a Barbie doll in my freezer. That had a very good ring to it. I was sure that would go over well with the department. Perhaps Sergeant Doakes would investigate personally and finally be allowed to indulge some hidden talents for unfettered interrogation. And perhaps they would simply fling me on the mentally unable to perform list, along with poor Deb, since officially the case was closing and even when open had nothing to do with Barbie dolls. No, there was really nothing to tell, not in any way that I could explain. So at the risk of another savage elbowing, I would not even tell Deborah. For reasons I could not begin to explain even to myself, this was personal. And by keeping it personal, there was a greater chance that I could get closer to my visitor. In order to bring him to justice, of course. Naturally. With the decision made, I felt much lighter, almost giddy, in fact. I had no idea what might come of it, but I was ready to go with whatever came. The feeling stayed with me through the night, and even through the next day at work, as I prepared a lab report, comforted Deb, and stole a donut from Vince Masuoka. It stayed with me during my drive home through the happily homicidal evening traffic. I was in a state of zen readiness, prepared for any surprise. Or so I thought. I had just returned to my apartment, leaned back in my chair and relaxed, when the phone rang. I let it ring. I wanted to breathe for a few minutes, and I could think of nothing that couldn't wait. Besides, I had paid almost $50 for an answering machine. Let it earn its keep. Two rings. I closed my eyes, breathed in. Relax, old boy. Three rings. Breathe out. The answering machine clicked, and my wonderfully urbane message began to play. Hello. I'm not in right now, but I'll get back to you right away if you'll please leave a message after the beep. Thank you. What fabulous vocal